morning, this afternoon. You may be seated. The students are here with the national award-winning program called Court with Class, which is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And the goal of this program is to have you, as students, attend an oral argument. You've been given material about the case that you have, you're about to hear. And did you meet at lunchtime with Justice Prosser?
No, not this group.
Well, had you come in the morning, you would have met with Justice Prosser. And you and other students who are here would have discussed the procedures of the court, not the substance. But if you have time after the oral argument, I'm sure Justice Prosser would be delighted to meet with you, and if he doesn't, I will. But I caution you that the snow is falling and sticking, so you may consider that in your time. So we're delighted to have you all. We have our case today, 06AP2851D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Joseph L. Summers. Before I call counsel, I want to explain to counsel, which they know, but to all of you, that this case is in the context of a pending Office of Lawyer Regulation disciplinary proceeding. And it's very unusual for this court to permit interlocutory review during an ongoing disciplinary proceeding. And it is important that in this oral argument, we remain focused on the issues that are before the court. And that neither counsel nor the court be sidetracked by matters that are not properly before the court at this time. No determination has yet been made on the allegations in the Office of Lawyer Regulations complaint. And we are not here today to discuss the underlying allegations in the OLR complaint. Attorney Summers refutes the charges against him, and we are not here to discuss the affirmative defenses that he has raised or may raise in his defense. Rather, the issue before the court today is a narrow one. The question we must resolve is whether the referee erred when he issued an order directing the Office of Lawyer Regulation to provide him with immediate access to the OLR's internal files. These files pertain to the respondent, Attorney Summers, and to Attorney Paul Humphrey, who is a respondent in a pending disciplinary matter. And the referee ordered the OLR to provide him with immediate access to the OLR's internal files so the referee could conduct an in-camera review of those files and perhaps disclose some or all of those files to Attorney Summers. So this is the question we have focused on and we must answer. We ask the parties to remain focused on the issue, and the court will endeavor to do the same. If any party or any justice strays from this limited issue about the OLR files into the realm of substantive allegations, we're going to ask you and we'll ask the justices to stop. The question is whether the OLR must comply with the referee's order and disclose in its internal files to the referee. We understand this issue implicates a respondent's right, or may implicate, a respondent's right to conduct a meaningful defense. However, we're all going to stay focused on the issue, and we expect you to discuss the legal basis for requiring disclosure or refusing disclosure of the files. And we expect you to address whether the same standard applies to the files regarding the respondent as compared to the files regarding Attorney Humphrey, a respondent in another albeit related pending disciplinary proceeding. With these comments in mind, I will ask Attorney Thomas J. Basting to proceed. Mr. Basting is counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Mr. Basting.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. As you indicated, my name is Thomas J. Basting, Sr., and I appear here today in this matter as special counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. With me at counsel table is Attorney Julie Falk, who assisted in the preparation of the brief in this matter and who is an assistant litigation counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. At the risk of repetition, let me repeat that the issue which this court, in its order of June 16, 2008, asked counsel to address is this. Can a referee in a disciplinary proceeding order the Office of Lawyer Regulation to provide him with full access to OLR's internal files, or should access be denied pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 22.41, privilege, and the work product doctrine? I submit to the court that the answer to this question, of course, is no. The referee cannot have full access to OLR's internal files for a variety of reasons. But before I elaborate on those reasons, I think it's important to set the stage and briefly review how this case has developed to this point. The complaint in this matter was filed on November 17, 2006, almost, well, in fact, more than 2 years ago now. The respondent filed a counterclaim alleging that OLR staff members engaged in misconduct. Time marched on. Discovery took place, a lot of discovery. The referee eventually decided that he did not have authority to adjudicate whether OLR staff had engaged in misconduct. The respondent then sought to depose the OLR director as an investigator and another OLR investigator. OLR filed a motion in limine and a request for a protective order in regard to the depositions, citing Supreme Court Rule 2241. The referee didn't rule on that motion and allowed the depositions to go forward in an order that is part of the respondent's appendix in this matter. At the depositions, the respondent made an oral request for OLR to produce its investigative files, and OLR refused. At a May 5, 2008 status conference, the respondent requested that the referee address whether the contents of OLR files had to be turned over to the respondent. The referee requested briefs on the issue. Parties provided them. At a status conference on May 9, 2008, the respondent, still without ever having filed a written discovery motion, orally requested the referee to determine whether the respondent could have access to OLR's internal investigative files. The referee then issued the order in question on this appeal. That order and the accompanying letter that came with that order said that the referee intended to present himself at OLR's offices in Madison to conduct an, quote, in-camera, unquote, review of the investigative files of OLR in this matter and an allegedly related matter involving a different respondent. OLR appealed. And here we are. The first question we have to ask, of course, is what authority does the referee in a disciplinary proceeding have? Supreme Court Rule 22.16, paren 1, gives to a referee the powers of a judge trying a civil action and requires the referee to conduct the hearing as the trial of a civil action to the court. This court has ordered its referees to follow the rules of civil procedure and the rules of evidence.
Counselor, if I understand your argument, then what you're essentially saying is because a trial judge in the circuit court, say for Dane County, couldn't, on the request of one of the parties, order the other party to turn over his or her files, this referee has no superior authority and can't do it either, right?
That's correct. The referee is the trier of fact, just as a judge in a trial to the court. She makes findings of fact based upon the evidence from the hearing, not from an improper inspection of the files of the lawyers appearing in the action.
Except and so, a little problem here, and that is that the lawyers are also the prosecutors. They're also the plaintiffs. And it's not unusual to ask plaintiffs to turn over files. Now, you may not ask the plaintiffs to turn over their lawyer files or their communications with the lawyers, but OLR here is a plaintiff. It is a charging official. Now, this talks, so it's not to say that they are the lawyers and you don't ask lawyers to turn over files. Not quite correct.
Well, the OLR is represented by lawyers.
That's right, but so not all their files are lawyer files or under lawyer-client privilege. All their investigative files? Are you claiming them all lawyer files?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Chief.
Well, on what basis are you saying they can't get these files?
On the basis they can't have the files is several, as I elaborated. Number one, work product. Number two, privilege. And number three, the extra layer of protection that this court provided to OLR under 2240 paren 1.
Work product. Compare this to a civil case.
Okay. We ask ourselves this question. Can a trial judge in a civil action before the court say to a lawyer for one of the parties, Mr. Basting, I'm going to show up at your office tomorrow and I order you to allow me to inspect your entire file on the matter before me and any related files as well. Would I allow
but
that?
Mr. Basting,
no, I certainly wouldn't.
No, but Mr. Basting, the OLR has files that have nothing to do with you. The OLR is an entity.
Correct.
It is represented by lawyers. But GM is an entity, too. And you can get their files. Maybe not all of them, but at least some of them.
I can't get the files that contain privileged or work product information of their lawyers.
Not every single
And if I was going to get their files, I would have to make an appropriate discovery request.
Your procedural arguments in your brief, I mean, I understand those. That is, that they didn't make the appropriate request at the appropriate time, and they didn't follow the laws, the rules of civil discovery. Okay. But your argument, that as I hear it in your response to Justice Robinsack, is all the files in OLR are lawyer files and can't be reached, and that I don't understand.
Well, I think the characterization that our position is that all of OLR's internal investigative files are lawyers' files may be a stretch of the argument. They certainly are files in the possession of the lawyers who represent OLR.
I know, but you can't hide files just by giving them to the lawyer.
No, of course you can't. But for example, in many cases, as you know, I have represented OLR as retained counsel.
Sure.
I have files in my office that are my files, and I look at OLR I'm part of the process, but...
They're your clients. OLR is your client.
OLR is the client.
Right.
That's correct. Just as the in-house counsel for OLR is representing OLR in this court.
Well, that is another issue I think we have to explore, because if you're saying this is lawyer product, there are lawyers that work internally for OLR, but there are investigators too. Not every investigator is a lawyer, is he or she?
That's correct. Not every investigator may not investigators. Right. Some investigators are lawyers. In this case, for example, the director, Mr. Saleen, who is a lawyer, mm-hmm. also acted as an investigator.
Mm-hmm. And were there other investigators too? They weren't acting in a legal capacity. They were acting as investigators.
Sure. Okay. While this file was being processed.
Well, why can't Mr. Summers get those files, the investigator files? Let's put aside the procedural matter.
Because 2240 says he can't.
All right. Let me just ask then for clarification. As I read the order dated May 14th, 2008, it is ordered that the referee have immediate access in camera to investigative files. So that's what we're talking about, isn't it, investigative files?
I don't think we have distinguished in this case between the investigative file of OLR and the entire file of OLR. It's all one file as far as I know. I don't think they keep a file that says this is the file that is the non-investigative file and this is the file that is the investigative file. They have files. They have an internal file on this matter that contains all of the documents and proceedings that took place before the PRC issued its for cause that directed, that eventually ended up with the filing of the formal complaint in this matter.
Are there any files that, if I said to you, I'm interested in taking a look at your investigation files? Do you know what you'd be giving me?
If you made a more specific request, I might know. For example, if you sent me a demand for production of documents pursuant to the rules of civil procedure, and you said to me, Mr. Basting, I want to see all exculpatory documents relating to this respondent that were turned over to the PRC. I then have the choice as counsel for OLR to say whether I'm going to allow you to look at those or not. But I would say to the referee, okay, we're going to give you these documents or we're not. And if not, here's why we're not going to give them to you, because mm-hmm. we're claiming some sort of a confidentiality defense or work product privilege or whatever. And I would list those documents. The referee can then make a decision as to whether those documents have to be turned over, and we have a record.
Okay, so you're saying a couple of things. One of the things you're saying, and it's in your brief, that really the rules of civil procedure and discovery require that there be some kind of a more carefully articulated denomination of the type of documents you're looking for. And yet I say, and I read that in your brief, I thought to myself, well, one of the things that's going on here is they want to make sure that things are filed in the right file. So it's a little hard to denominate anything in that kind of a circumstance, it seems to me.
That may be one of them, but of more importance to me is the creation of a record for an appellate court to be able to review when this issue becomes ripe for review. I'm not saying that OLR will turn over these documents, but they need a specific request as to what they're supposed to turn over, rather than some unfettered, broad examination by a referee of everything in OLR's files. That's what he was asking to do.
Well, maybe that is. I don't know that. You're telling me that is, but I know by the order He is asking for in-camera investigation of investigation files. Let's say I'm a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Oof, here I am. And I need some information, and the court needs some information from OLR, from the Office of Lawyer Regulation. And so we draft an order, you know, and we say, give us your send over for our review your investigative file in this matter. What am I going to get? What's the court going to get?
You probably would get a response if I was counsel for OLR saying, with all due respect, Justice Bradley, could you be more specific?
Well, I would say, you know, years ago, just down the road from Merrill, I used to work at Wausau Insurance Companies. And in the claims department, of course, they would have investigative files, and then there would be a legal department that would have the legal files. So I'd say, give me your investigative files. That's what I would say. And I'd say to you, don't you have something like that? Are you meaning to tell me that the investigators at OLR, with whom, you know, there are several investigators, that once they finish their investigation and they work up, they say, here's my file, now put it in yours, would you please? And then the file just gets larger and larger, and everyone puts something in a single individual file. Is that what's going on at OLR? I don't know, but I'm asking you. Is that
what's going on? Well, I will confess that I don't know either, because I don't work inside of OLR, and I'm not sure exactly how they're handled. But my guess would be that that they do keep separate litigation and investigative files.
That's what my guess would be too. and so, give me your investigative files and you would be able to do that. It wouldn't be such an impossible task, but for the other arguments that you raise here. But it seems to me that there is such an entity that exists.
Is there such an entity? Yes, there is. That's what I'm told.
Mr. Basting, I've got a couple of questions I'd like to ask. To begin with, it's my understanding that the referee talked about reviewing the files in camera.
Yes.
What that triggers for me is a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, where the U.S. Supreme Court said there are certain situations where indeed it's appropriate for a judge, or perhaps in this case a referee, to be able to review things in camera and to determine what items might or might not be relevant to the issues facing the court. And there is some real protection provided by an in-camera inspection. Why isn't that protection sufficient in this case?
Here, it was the understanding of OLR from the referee's order that the referee was going to present himself at OLR's offices, first of all. And I had trouble with this as well, Justice Crooks, and that was in camera usually contemplates a proceeding held in the judge's chamber where the judge would order documents be brought to court, for example, bring to court such and such, and I, the judge, am going to then go into chambers and conduct an in-camera inspection outside the presence of anyone to determine whatever it is I'm trying to determine at that stage. Here, we don't know what the referee was trying to determine. Was the referee acting as some sort of a surrogate counsel for the respondent in this case? The order is not clear, and the events leading up to the order, as I went through them in my recitation of the facts, really do not make clear what it was that the referee was looking for, because we don't have a motion that was made to the referee, for example, that said, I, the respondent, want to see X, X, and X in this file. So there was no record to be able to create. So this was kind of an, of a broad examination, and there really aren't any protections. As I understand the Supreme Court case that you referred to, that says in-camera inspections are sometimes appropriate, there's some specificity in those cases as to what it is the judge is looking for, and the judge is usually saying, bring this document or these three documents that you have put into this privilege log to me so I can determine as the judge whether in fact they are attorney-client communications, work product, whatever it is that the issue happens to be before the judge. We don't have that here. We have this blanket, I want to come in and look at your files.
Counselor Green.
I have one other question. I know that one of the things that you're relying on here is Supreme Court Rule 2240.
Yes.
And my question in that regard is, what provision specifically are you relying on in terms of saying, no, you don't have to turn over these files to the referee?
2240 Paragraph 1, Justice Crooks, provides, in essence, that prior to the filing of a complaint, all papers, files, transcripts, and communications in any matter involving the OLR are to be held in confidence by the director and staff of the OLR. The rule further provides that following the filing of a complaint or petition, the proceeding, what this court said, and all papers filed in it are public. And the rule then goes on to delineate numerous exceptions where the director of OLR or this court may release certain information from OLR's files. Now, I know the respondent has argued in this case that that provision means that once the complaint is filed publicly in this court, that everything OLR has in its files are then open to public inspection, and we believe that is would be an absurd rule because it would not then accept attorney-client communications. It would not accept work product, the mental images, or the mental works, the everything that traditionally is not subject to discovery under Dudek unless there are special circumstances.
What do you think is open to the public when it says the proceeding and all papers filed therein are open to the public? What specifically would be your position that covers?
Well, if one looks at the record in this case, which is attached to the respondent's appendix, which contains all of the documents that have been filed in this case, it is those documents that are filed with the referee and subsequently make up the record in this court that are subject to public inspection, not only by the respondent, but by anybody. That's what I believe that means. And of course, what the OLR was doing here was saying, okay, the Supreme Court has told us that these documents are confidential and we're not to release them.
Well,
unless we are ordered to do so in an appropriate order that from somebody who has the proper authority to do so.
Ms. Rosenzweig, do you have a question?
Yeah, no, you can go ahead.
sentence that you're citing from 2240, following the filing of a complaint or petition, the proceeding and all papers filed in it are public. That you're relying on that language, aren't you?
Yes. That's part of what we're relying on, Justice Crooks. Justice Prosser, I'm sorry.
I'm having...
It's all right, I confuse them too.
You all look alike.
Well, not all of us.
I'm having trouble. A case is started, so the proceeding begins. But there haven't been any hearing yet. I suspect a respondent would want to know in discovery what is going to be filed, not what has been filed.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question.
You're prosecuting me, let's
yes.
say, Okay. And we have a hearing coming up in February.
Yes.
If we're in discovery, I want to know what evidence you got against me.
Of course.
Okay. What are you going to file in February? That's what I want.
Well, what you mean what I'm going to file before the proceeding in this court starts?
No, no. When it comes to the climax, so to say.
Right, right. During the proceeding, the respondent is entitled to all the discovery that's allowed a civil litigant under the rules of civil procedure. The respondent can issue written interrogatories, demands for production of document, demands for inspection if it's appropriate. He's entitled to all of those things, and that's perfectly appropriate. It's done all the time. It wasn't done in this case.
As I read this, there seems to be a complaint here that somehow the demands of the respondent have not been committed to writing. Is that correct?
That's part of it. There have been no formal motions for the discovery of particular documents. There have been no written interrogatories, no demands for production in the usual sense. You know, this court has said on numerous occasions how important it is to create a record in cases that come before this court, whether they be OLR or otherwise, and that hasn't been done here.
But I think the issue is larger than that, because committing something to writing could be remedied relatively easily.
Of course.
Then the question is, well, once you've committed to writing, if that's essential, how far can you go into the files? And one of the arguments seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, that really it shouldn't be the referee who is rummaging around in the files. But if it isn't the referee, and it isn't the respondent, do you have a third option? Because you cite 80401 for the proposition that we want to protect all the mental processes and legal theories and all of those things.
Well, the traditional exceptions to discovery under the work product rule and the privilege rule, yes.
If it isn't the referee who does the protecting, well, who the heck is it?
Traditionally, in civil cases, what occurs is that if discovery is going to occur and a defendant or a respondent wants to obtain documents from a party, a written request, a specific request is made. I want all documents relating to this. In this case, for example, I want all exculpatory materials relating to the respondent that were turned over by OLR to the PRC. I want copies of all those documents. That is a specific request that OLR can respond to. Now, whether they're going to give them the documents or not depends on the documents. I can't give you a blanket answer that they're going to say, yes, we will. But that's how this is done. I think your question goes to the issue of what if the referee suspects or the respondent suspects that OLR is somehow lying in its responses, I guess. How do we know whether they are going to be truthful? How do we know that in any case, whether a party or a lawyer for a party is responding appropriately? That's why we have these procedures in place to do that. The referee could then say, I want you to give me copies of all documents you turned over to the PRC. OLR can then say, okay, here's a list of all of them.
I suppose there are documents that weren't turned over to the PRC.
Well, then he should say, I want a list of all documents that were not turned over to the PRC. And the OLR can provide a list of those or object to whether or not they even have to provide a list. But then we would know what the documents were. We would have a record that this court could ultimately say, okay, they had to turn this document over or they didn't, depending on what it was. But what we have here is, I'm going to show up at your office and look at your files. That's what the referee did in this case.
What is the referee looking for when he asks for an in-camera inspection?
I don't know.
That's not clear in this record.
I don't believe so.
What about the order? As I recall, I don't have it right in front of me now, but the order, right here it is. Page 2, the order, there's a couple of number 2s, top number 2. It says, the referee determined that he should have an in-camera review of the files prior to any decision being made on the respondent's motion because, among other matters, it's pretty broad, that there is some confusion as to whether all of the respondent's filings with OLR prior to the complaint were contained in his file versus the related Paul Humphrey file. I took that to be, in my mind, number one, that he wanted to make sure that the right things were filed in the right files. Number two, and I'm adding that, it doesn't appear in the text, whether these materials were turned over to the district committees. Well, I'm not sure what he means, but I'll tell you what I interpreted it to mean. In other words, if there was something that was ascertained to be misfiled, whether those materials that were misfiled were turned over to the district committees. Number three, again, I just insert that, whether these materials were turned over to the preliminary review committee. And so that's the way that I interpreted what was being sought. Do you think that's right or do you think it's wrong?
If you're reading from what was occurring, I was not part of the process when that was going on, so I can't specifically answer your question, except to say this, Justice Bradley, so what? I mean, we have the Eisenberg's case that says all of what goes on during this investigation is really, respondents aren't entitled to due process at that stage of the proceeding. And whether documents internally were turned over or not turned over, I mean, our response is it doesn't make any difference. We aren't there yet because we don't know what specific documents are being talked about. I understand the respondent is saying that I gave OLR a whole bunch of stuff that I suspect they did not turn over to the PRC.
That's right.
I have all the documents, basically, is what the respondent is saying. I know what I gave them, so it's not that he doesn't have the documents. He has them all. What he's saying is, I gave you this stuff, you didn't turn it over. My answer is, so what? We weren't required to turn it over.
I understand that. I just want...
But this goes in a different direction because what you're asking is... I guess, what was the referee looking for?
I read from his order, by the way. It wasn't part of the transcript.
Right.
It was the order. Okay, that's it. Thank you, Mr. Basting. You have
May I just wrap up briefly?
Wrap up very quickly, because you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
What I wanted to say that, what's the upshot of all of this? And I think it's important for us to look at that. And here's what I believe it is. And that is that if this court allows the unfettered access by referees and respondents to OLR's internal investigative files, I submit to you that the results will be disastrous. How disastrous? Well, it may result in OLR not being able to do its job. For example, if OLR's lawyers, both in-house and retained, knew that their communications with each other, their mental impressions, their theories of the case, and all other traditionally protected documents, memos, and communications were subject to inspection by the referee as the trier of fact, and possibly by the respondent, I submit that these folks, including retained counsel, would say, thanks, but no thanks, I'll find work elsewhere. Lawyers need the protection afforded by Dudek, afforded by the statutes of privilege communications between lawyers and clients and lawyers within a file. And what the referee here is basically saying is, I want to see all of that. And that's not right. And what this court should really do, it should deny the referee's requested unfettered access to those records, reverse the referee's order of May 14th, and return this matter to the referee for the prompt scheduling of a disciplinary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Basting. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Summers, Joseph Summers, representing himself.
Your Honor, I think a good part for Attorney Joe Summers on behalf of himself, if it pleases the court. I think a good place for me to start, actually, is where he ended. He at one point said, so what? And he also ended by saying, not right. Well, this would not be right. You know, and I got to say, the OR argument is a pretty clever argument because it wants this court to overlook something that's so basic it's actually slapping everybody in the face. And OR knows that it's slapping everybody in the face, and that's why at all costs they have to prevent it from happening. There is no authority, basically. He said, I have no right to due process, apparently, for what goes to the preliminary review committee. And he also made a statement to the effect, like, there was no obligation at that point in time, where, if I read it right, for that information to have been passed on. There's no due process. There's 2206, Your Honor. Supreme Court Rule 2206. And under that rule, the director was obligated to provide all relevant exculpatory and inculpatory information obtained to the PRC. He also, Your Honor, and that didn't happen in this case, and he made it sound as if, like, that's my version. I'm throwing it out. Maybe that's my spin. And that doesn't do the record justice at all. That's the testimony of Keith Saleen, the director of OLR. Now, it is true that when Mr. Saleen first testified, he did testify that basically all these documents had been turned over. But then he had to admit that wasn't true. It wasn't accurate. And, in fact, Your Honor, I have given you, I put it in my appendix, at least some of the documents that were not turned over. And if this court did bother to look at my appendix and to look at what was attachment C, this court will see that basically I had provided to OLR a very thorough document that basically pinpointed transcripts, pinpointed other documents, and at the time, actually, those transcript pages and those documents were attached. All of that.
Counsel?
What's that?
If you have these documents, why are you seeking them?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, is what we're seeking, and again, Your Honor, this all goes back to what the court actually ruled, the referee. And incidentally, his claim the referee did not rule on the motion, that too is not accurate. The order drafted specifically by OLR to what he ruled, by Julie Thaw, is actually Appendix B. B of my appendix. He, in fact, did do that. If you go to the very last paragraph, you'll see that, contrary to what he represented to you, he did actually, in Ms. Falk's own words, he did say Attorney Summers would basically be permitted to depose Mr. Saleen. Also,
that's not what was represented.
That was what represented. He represented that she made a motion and that I could not depose Mr. Saleen. That was part of this whole thing.
The depositions went forth. They never represented that they did not comply.
He represented that the referee didn't rule on it. The referee didn't. Right. And the referee did rule on it. He specifically ruled on it. She knew that he ruled on it. That's why she drafted that paragraph 5. Because he did rule on it. There was no issue. There was never any debate that he ruled on it. Everybody knew that he did. And if you go to paragraph 4, Your Honor, you'll see, actually, that's the critical thing, too, they want you to overlook. He's made a big deal over and over that I didn't file any specific motion and this kind of stuff. Because what he's done, though, is take something out of the record and put it in a very different context. The real context of what took place was this.
Counsel, let me just interrupt
sure.
a little bit. During the depositions, did you ask Mr. Saleen or any other person from OLR that you deposed about particularized documents so you could get some descriptive name of those documents?
Oh, yeah, sure. Actually, right, we had asked Mr. Saleen to bring a file. He first did not bring a file. He then made a representation that certain documents were not contained in my file. He was confronted with documents that had an OLR stamp on it, so then he reversed himself and admitted those documents indeed were in the file, and the hearing was adjourned, so he could go back.
Sorry, but I must have phrased the question.
But the point I'm going to get to is, there was a number of documents that we did. There's a lot of other documents that we don't. And for example, I'll give you one example.
My question was, let's just listen to the question and answer that, and then you can move on to what you want to say.
Right. Can you just listen to the question, counselor? Sure.
During the deposition, did you make a particularized identification of documents through your interaction with the deponent so that we could see whether or not that was properly provided or properly denied to you? Is that in the deposition transcripts?
Right. I'm trying to answer that. I'm trying to put forth that I did the best I could, but there is a problem with that, if you will allow me to explain. For example, when he testified, he admitted that three paragraphs in the complaint against me were untrue, and that he knew that they were untrue. Now, we don't know what document he's, that's where I'm getting to, we don't know what document he's basing it off of. They wouldn't let us see it. He told us that there was an investigation that cleared me on, for the materials in these three paragraphs. He claimed he couldn't give any explanation to why I was accused by OLR in this complaint when he knew both paragraph 4 untrue. What document he's talking about, I cannot reference greater than what he has, or better than what he just said, which was, we did an investigation, us in the district attorney's office, it was concluded.
Did they tell you what paragraphs of the complaint he had determined were not true?
Yes.
Could you describe a document that says, please provide the document on which you relied when you determined that paragraphs 1, 2, and 3 of the complaint were not accurate?
Did I do that during the deposition?
Would you have done that from the deposition testimony?
I don't know, that was never considered, because again, we're taking things out of context.
I'm just asking you a question. Okay,
could
you
I
just
do it
answer
now?
Me yes or no. Yes. How about right now?
I'm not sure you.
So you couldn't ask him, even after the deposition, what document or documents he relied on to determine that paragraphs 1, 2, 3 of the complaint were not true?
Yes, I could do that, but there's another problem that would arise.
Okay, what would be the problem?
OLR has been caught, in this case, a number of times, probably at least a half a dozen, where they have made actual, factual representations that they did not possess documents that they did possess. So just because Mr. Saleen would say, I don't have that document, could not be trusted, as shown in this case.
Did you ever ask him for the document?
OLR had basically said they wouldn't turn it over. That was the point of the deposition. Yes, we did ask
him. You did ask him that in the deposition, and he said, no, we won't turn it over?
You're right. But he did say he would. He did say.
The date of the deposition, do you know?
I think it was April, it was either April 9th, April 14th, or April 15th. What he did also say, though, is he would comply with any order from the referee. And when the referee ordered it, he then, all of our position was, he would not comply. But he did testify to that under oath.
Well, my understanding is that OLR did not ask for a defined document. I've been sitting here reading the order, and I don't see a document or documents that show that paragraphs 1, 2, and 3 of the complaint are incorrect, and this is what was relied on.
Because, Your Honor, when you interrupted me, I was getting to the point to why that is so. The reason why that is so is because things have been taken out of context. What actually took place in this case was, there was a counterclaim made by me.
I understand that. No, now it's an affirmative defense.
The referee's ruling is intimately connected to that. So if you remove the referee's ruling, you won't understand the context.
I understand you made an affirmative defense, and you're going to be allowed to go forward on it, but that is not why we are here today.
Yes, it is why you're here.
No, it is not.
Your Honor,
why if
you
we
permit me
today.
To point out why you're here today, is if you go to paragraph 4, you will see that when he made that ruling, The referee made the specific ruling that I would be permitted to basically pursue whether Olerar withheld relevant factual information contained in Olerar's file. That's what Julie Falk drafted. That's on page 2 of my appendix, paragraph 4.
So you're looking at paragraph 4, appendix 105, is that what you're looking
paragraph
at?
Paragraph 4.
The order of the referee?
I'm looking at the proposed order that Julie Falk drafted.
I'm looking at what the referee signed.
Well, we have a little problem with the page numbering in your appendix, a little odd.
So
let's just open to your appendix.
My appendix. If you go to...
Just a minute. There's an order regarding counterclaims. Is that what you're talking about?
If you go to my appendix, it's B. I have A, B, and C. A is Circuit Court.
No, that's what you've got in your appendix, but where is it labeled in the rest of the appendix? Where can I find A, B? What page?
Very first page. I have a table of contents, very first page.
I understand that table of contents, but usually a table of contents directs you to something, right? And you direct me to A, but I don't know what page it is in your appendix. You'd make life easier for the court, counsel, if you have numbers at the bottom of your pages, 182.6, 182.3, then you've got unnumbered pages 1, 2, and 3. So tell me, what is Appendix A?
Appendix A is the Circuit Court docket. Appendix B is Attorney Falk's proposed order. That was a transcribed.
The first few pages. What is the title for that? Does it look like this?
It's B.
We don't have a B, counsel. If we did, we wouldn't be having this anymore.
Well, can I approach your bench? I can point it out to you. It's super easy. I got it in my hand. I don't know how this court's confused, to be honest.
All right. Just look at what you're doing. Yes. Why don't you show it to Attorney Basting first, yep. Please?
He's there. He found it. Appendix D, right?
Bottom left.
The B is just described.
That's the problem. Thank you.
B.
Okay, now where is it? Where is it in your appendix? There's a reference in the table. What's it labeled as?
Order regarding counterclaims.
See, I asked you.
Oh, I apologize.
It's order regarding counterclaims. Yes, it's unnumbered. And it's not labeled B.
It's the first document after all of the entries.
After the docket.
Yeah, the docket.
Mm-hmm. All right. Was this signed?
No, that's the order drafted by Attorney Falk after he made those oral rulings on February 29, 2008. He made those rulings. There was a hearing. He made those rulings.
What is the point that you're trying to make, counsel?
The point I'm trying to make is when the judge did not give me a counterclaim, he said, I won't give you a counterclaim, but instead I'm going to give you something different, basically. You can put on this affirmative defense, and part of this affirmative defense, we are going to go into what evidence was withheld from the Olerar file.
All right. Now, what is the relation between the affirmative defense now and the order seeking Olerar's investigative file? On what basis do you say the OLR had authority, I'm sorry, that the referee had authority to turn over the investigative files to the referee for in-camera inspection? What is the basis of your authority?
The basis of the authority is, one, is there's no authority to the contrary. Two, he definitely would have had the authority under 2206. 2206,
okay, basically. 2206.
The Supreme Court Rule 2206 says that Olerar is obligated. It says, paragraph 1, that
This is to the preliminary review committee. We're beyond that, aren't we?
Right.
No, but actually, Your Honor, I think it's we are beyond that. But this is, but that would be like the preliminary hearing stage at a criminal trial.
Right.
And so, if, for example, a preliminary hearing was done in a way that violated due process, a trial court is always given the opportunity to go back and to correct it. You can make a motion. The same thing is true here. My most basic right of all was that I have the right not to be accused in bad faith and false. Holder had no right to withhold exculpatory evidence from the committee. They had no right to give the committee evidence that they knew was false or distorted. That's my most basic right of all. And that's actually what the deposition testimony has already proven in this case. We don't know the full extent of it, but we know that it is substantial. We know, again, this is all basically, for the most part, this is all based upon the testimony of Mr. Saleem. So that's my most basic right of all. And actually, from that, isn't it true then, I could make a couple motions? One, I could make a motion for summary judgment, possibly, from that information. Two, I could make a motion to dismiss. Three, I could also probably use that evidence in my own defense if it got beyond that. And four, even if, let's say, worst came to worst, it still would be mitigating evidence for whatever should happen to me. So it's all relevant. And it was my most basic right of all. Didn't I have the right to be protected under 2206? Or is that something that can just be dispensed with at the snap of a finger because OLR decides they don't want to?
Counselor, during the course of your deposition of Mr. Saleem, from what you're saying, I understand that you learned if there was certain information which you believe is exculpatory that was not turned over to the PRE. Is that correct?
I don't think it can be debated by anybody. Mr. Saleem has conceded what the documents show. I've outlined it in my brief. He's conceded point after point after point after point that it proved misconduct, as I alleged during Raceback on the Dane County District Attorney's Office. He has conceded that.
Then why do you need this in-camera review by the ultimate finder of fact in your case?
Because we don't know the extent of it, number one. Two, we also don't know how much information was given to the PRC that was false. And we have a good faith basis to believe that. And again, there is a report that surfaced, which for a whole month, OLR tried to claim it was done by somebody out of their office. It was done by somebody in their office. That report has been shown has all kinds of factual assertions that are just false. So if the PRC was fed a bunch of false information, is that a so what? Is he what happened? Is that so what? I said that's the most basic thing of all of due process. And in fact, I would go where Justice Prosser was going. He's saying, well, should there be a third option? And I would say yes. If it's not the referee who is going to do it, I would put forth, with all due respect, it should be this very court. Because this very court, as OLR has said, OLR has characterized itself as the in-house law firm of this very court. So I would put forth, yes, there should be an in-camera inspection, and I believe it should include this court. Because 2206 matters a lot. That's probably the most basic Supreme Court rule in the OLR scheme of things.
Mr. Summers, if I may, I think you compared the preliminary review committee to a preliminary examination in a criminal case. Is that fair?
I didn't make the comparison.
Okay. In a preliminary examination in a criminal case, the court makes a judgment whether there is enough evidence to go forward. And maybe I don't understand the preliminary review committee very well, but basically my understanding is that the preliminary review committee is not making a judgment ultimate result, but determining whether it is fair and reasonable on the basis of evidence to go forward with some sort of a complaint, because it's the referee who will make a judgment on the facts. So one can fully concede that probably more information should be presented to the preliminary review committee than would, in a parallel situation, be presented to the court at a preliminary examination. But I don't think that's fatal. How does that provide a defense to whatever there is sort of probable cause for?
Actually, Your Honor, and I want to say this with all due respect, I think you're a little bit, I think your perspective is a little bit off in this regard. OR has the ability to financially destroy somebody. So that's it. Finish. Financial ruin. That's what I'm facing right now. Now, if, let's say, I have been accused, and actually I have been accused, I believe, in bad faith, and in fact, documents that prove that it was not fair and reasonable to charge me were withheld. I believe that is a big deal. I believe that is a super big deal. And this thing, as he said, has gone on for a long period of time. Yes, it has, Your Honor. And I have 12 kids. And I've tried very hard to be an honest attorney. And I haven't made a big buck. This thing has financially, basically, hit me in a big way. Maybe even financially ruined me. Already right now, I bet my cost out of my own pocket easily passed $30,000, Your Honor. That's not counting all the time that I've had to give up. So I think it does make a big deal. And in fact, if it isn't a big deal, then that means why go through a dog and pony show to make it look as if people are being protected? Why not then take out 2206? Because if 2206 doesn't have to be obeyed, if they don't have to follow 2206, in that case, take it out. Don't give off this fiction to people that attorneys will only be charged after the exculpatory and inculpatory information and evidence is presented. If that's not going to take place, remove the fiction and at least allow the public to know what's what.
Let me see if I can understand what this is about. We have a complaint, right? Claim's been filed. Is that correct, Mr. Summers?
Yeah.
We're in the discovery stage so that you can make an appropriate defense. Is that right?
We were. I'm not quite sure. I don't. We're sort of beyond that stage, but go ahead.
Thank you. So you're in the defense mode, and appropriately so. And it seems to me that your discovery is going to relate to a defense. That defense might be that we shouldn't be here at all because the preliminary review committee should never have passed this because it didn't get all the information. That may be a defense. Is that one of your defenses?
Yeah.
Okay. Now the defense is that the charges are just not accurate and they don't reflect what happened, or even if they reflect what happened, they don't violate a particular code provision, right?
Yes.
Okay. And it would seem to me that the referee would have to look at your defenses and see if the request for discovery is relevant, broadly speaking, relevant to those defenses. Is that right?
And he has already done that.
Well, what he's done is he has issued an order. But where in the order have you given him the information of what you need? And I know you don't know what you need because you don't know what's in the files. I mean, that's a problem on seeking discovery. But where have you set forth your arguments for the need for the investigative files? And where have you set forth, that would be a factual kind of argument, your legal argument for the basis?
Well, two, Your Honor. One is, I have made a request to get a document in specific. And we know that Mr. Saleem gave a document to the PRC. We have not received that document. We've asked about it. We didn't bring it when he was deposed. When the referee asked me what documents in the file in specific you would want him, that I would want him to take a look at, that document has been put forth by me. And so that is one document that I think can be put forth, I mean, that I have put forth, and it is my belief that that document in itself will basically take away a lot of the problem. Second, in regards to my legal argument, Your Honor, I have made my legal argument in large part on based upon 2206, and in large part because I have gone through the record, and they have not been disputed. Olor has been caught time after time after time after time, making a factual representation to the contents of the file that has proven not to be true. How many times are they permitted to do so? I don't know. But it doesn't make any sense. And to trust them now, I would say, would be folly, and it would be unfair, and it would violate my right to due process. Nobody would trust somebody who's been caught 6-7 times making representations that are not accurate. And you can't just gloss over it. That has taken place in this case over and over and over again. They have said, we don't have this document. It's shown they have that document. People have come to depositions where they were subpoenaed to bring documents. They have not brought documents, only for the documents to surface later on and for it to be discovered that OR had the documents. That too has taken place in this case.
Your time is running, and I want you to address one thing we haven't talked about yet. And there were two files that you have had the referee request information about, yours and the file of Attorney Humphreys. Are those two files, in your view, to be treated the same way in regard to the referee's authority to demand an in-camera review of them, or are they different?
Actually, I have never made any such request. Olor represented that the files were the same. The reason why it's been based that way is that I don't have any idea what is Humphrey's file versus what is my file. It is Olor that has said Humphrey's file and my file are one and the same. That's where that comes from. That doesn't come from me.
Oh, so if it's a separate file, you're not interested in Attorney Humphrey's separate file?
Well,
I misunderstood.
No. Based upon what Olor has said, I believe that it is relevant, basically, if they are one and the same. What I'm interested in, basically, in showing is that in regards to Humphrey or the DA's office, everything I said was true. I provided documentation to that effect, and I believe Olor knew that it was true. And that's what I'm trying to see, whether or not that was passed on. But where that came from did not come from me.
Okay.
It came from Olor.
Do you want Humphrey's file or not? If it's a separately labeled file, Humphrey, do you want it? Do you want the referee to see it, or don't you?
If it has materials that relate to my claims to Olor, yes. If it doesn't, no.
You want to see any material in Humphrey's file that relates to you? Won't that be a substantial amount since the two of you were involved in this case together?
That is what I believe, Your Honor. Olor has represented that files are one and the same. My understanding is, and this is what I believe Mr. Saleem testified to, is that when he went to the PRC, the time he went to the PRC, they were the very same file. And so if that's true, this is a sort of an academic argument. That's my understanding. At the time that he went to the PRC, Humphrey's file and my file were one and the same.
Let me get some more clarification. It was my understanding when I was reading from Appendix A which is the conference and order allowing referee in-camera inspection of OLR investigation files dated May 14th, 2008. In my referencing number two at the top of the second page, it says, the referee determined that he should have an in-camera review of the files prior to my decision, being his decision, being made on the respondent's motion because, among other matters, there is some confusion as to whether all of the respondent's filings with OLR prior to the complaint were contained in his file versus the related Paul Humphrey file. I thought that that meant this. That when the parties reviewed the public files, there seemed to be some misfilings. And I thought that what, based on the language that I just read, that referee Hack says, because there is some confusion as to whether all of the respondents' filings with OLR prior to the complaint were contained in his file versus the Humphrey file, he wanted to review that file. Well, maybe I'm wrong. Now you're saying something else. I guess I want to know what you want and why.
Your Honor, he references pages of transcript, and that's I guess page 19 and page 30 of May 9, 2008. My understanding, the way I recall what took place that day, we had already had this ruling on his part that I'd be able to put on evidence to the evidence that was withheld. I had informed him to what Mr. Saleen had testified to and provided him with the transcript pages to Mr. Saleen's testimony. And then he basically agreed with me, and that was it. OLR didn't put up, they didn't say anything at the time, and that was it. The hearing just ended that day. OLR didn't say to him, you can't do this. OLR didn't say to him, we object. OLR said, you don't show up next week. Nothing. And that was it. Basically, it was going over that it was being said that I could put on this evidence, me giving him an update to it, me saying, is this going to happen? Him saying, yes, to OLR, I need you, basically, I need to see the file, and them basically saying, okay, that's it. That's all that took place that day. And so when he references that, I'm not quite sure, but I don't think that will match up to what was on the transcript. But that's what took place on that day. Which was May 9, 2008. And I see that my time is up. Unless there's any other questions, I guess that's it.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Summers. Mr. Basting?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bainstein, I want to ask you about that document that Mr. Saleen provided to the PRC, thank you. Was the document requested during his deposition or at any time?
I was not present at the deposition, and as I tried to review it quickly for purposes of this hearing, I can't tell you specifically that it was or was not requested.
Okay, does OLR object to giving him the document?
Since I don't know what the document is, I can't tell you and give you a specific answer. I'm sorry, but I did not review that transcript in full, so I'm not sure what document we're talking about. If it's a document that, if the request is, was there a document that you submitted to the PRC pursuant to 2206, whatever the documents were, and we know what those documents are, OLR can then say whether they object to giving that or not. I mean, what we do know here is that Saleen submitted documents to the PRC. We know that the PRC held a hearing. We know that the PRC found cause to proceed and that's that the OLR director then was able to and had the authority to go ahead and file a complaint in this court. That's what we know. What I was going to point out, and we cited Eisenberg, the Eisenberg case in our brief, and In that case, this court clearly held that an attorney's right to due process involves notice of the charges, to prepare to defend the charges, and a full hearing on the charges. In that case, Attorney Eisenberg, at that time when he was a lawyer, moved to dismiss the complaint on constitutional grounds, claiming prejudice because, quote, his offer to appear and provide information during the investigative phase, unquote, was rejected. The referee denied his motion, and this court stated, quote, the referee properly denied that motion on the grounds that there was no due process required at and during the investigative stage of a grievance procedure. Which brings me to my point in reply here today, and that is that we have heard throughout this case, as you look at this long, long record and what was argued here today, that the respondent here, first in his failed counterclaim, in his brief, apparently in a letter which I understood he recently sent to the court, argues at length that OLR staff have violated the rules of this court by not, as I understand it, in effect, giving certain documents that the respondent claims are exculpatory to his case to the PRC. He seems to be arguing, in spite of the fact that he's not entitled to due process at that stage of the proceedings, he seems to be arguing that therefore, had OLR given these documents, whatever they are, to the PRC, if in fact they didn't, that the PRC would have not found cause to proceed, and therefore he would not have been charged with the offenses. Now, this court has also promulgated Supreme Court Rule 22.25. And you all know what that is. And that is that if the respondent desires, if he feels he has a case that's not frivolous, that members of the OLR staff have violated these rules deliberately and are somehow committing fraud.
Well, I think we're getting off the track a little bit here.
Well, he has a right to...
I understand what the rules provide that he can do later after the disciplinary matter is over.
He can do it now if he wants to.
Right, but what I'm more interested in just having you focus one last time on why you think there is no authority for the referee to order that the referee gets to look at the information requested in this May 14th, 2008 order.
Because the 2008 May 14th order is a blanket order without any specific documents, the referee is saying, I want to see OLR's files on the Summers matter and on the Humphrey matter. I want to come to OLR's office and I want to look at OLR's files. There's no authority in the law for him to do that. There would be no authority for a circuit court judge to do that. This court has said the rules of civil procedure shall apply. They have not been followed here. This court has said and has told the referee what the referee's powers are, not only under the common law, but also in 2240 Paran 1, which we believe, OLR believes, says that these files are confidential.
Thank you, Mr. Basting, and thank you, Mr. Summers, for your argument in this unusual issue. Justices Ziegler and Gableman will not be participating. That concludes our hearing in 2851D, OLR versus Summers. The court will meet at 3:25. We are adjourned until our January hearing.